This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here through the hour to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Have a question for Zorba? Give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with our callers, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, restless leg syndrome. Sometimes you see those ads all over the television station and radio stations. And in fact, now that there will be generic drugs on the market, the ads may take a hike.
And, well, we'll talk about it. What else?
Teens, smoking bans. If you have a smoking ban in your city, how does that affect your teenager and whether or not your teenager smokes?
Okay, and our recipe?
Spring Loaded Turkey Breasts. I bet you're excited by that name, and you'll be even more excited by the recipe.
And we have our medical myth buster coming up, too. Lots of good reasons for you to stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
I just wanted to check with Dr. Pastor. A few days ago, I was playing in the backyard with the dog, and approximately 2 or 3 hours later, when I was getting ready for my shower, I noticed a tick on my hip. So, of course, I took it off and put it, you know, did whatever you do to ticks when you're getting rid of them.
Well, you always live release them. You never want to kill a tick, of course.
Oh, okay.
No, wait a minute. What do you mean you never want to kill a tick? Where did that come from?
Animal rights.
Mr. Animal rights for ticks. Animal rights for ticks. I'm sorry. It's all we have.
When we're done, make sure you give me the address, and I'll send them right up to you.
You know what? The American Tick Association thanks you.
Okay, Peter, I'm clear with you guys for a while. All right, how can we help you?
Okay. After I had taken the tick off, you know, went to sleep, the next morning when I woke up and was getting dressed, I found a bullseye on my hip exactly where the tick was.
Hmm.
Should I be concerned about that? Should I get a test for it? Because it couldn't have been on my body for more than 2 hours.
Well, the answer is actually pretty clear. If a tick, in order to transfer Lyme disease to you, has to be on your body more than 24 hours.
Oh,
so the answer is less than 2 hours, the tick is not an issue. That's really crucial. And generally, it's been shown 99.99% of the time, really, really high. It's got to be there for more than 24 hours. So if somebody goes out to the woods, they haven't been in the woods, they say, there's a tick on my body, they've got a tick, less than 24 hours, they need not worry.
Well, what about the bullseye?
Well, the bullseye, first of all, that's a local reaction. The bullseye you get from Lyme disease does not occur the day after you get Lyme disease. In other words, let's assume the tick was on there for 2 days, transferred Lyme disease. The rash doesn't appear that day. It appears, I think it's about a week later. I would have to look that up, but it's somewhere in that range. It's about 3 days would be really early, 7 days would be very common. It can occur up to about a month afterwards. And it's not at all necessarily at the site of the bite. It's anywhere in the body. In other words, it's a systemic disease like measles and chickenpox, and it causes a systemic rash. So the rash would not appear at the bite. It could appear anywhere on the body. And so what you had was you had a local reaction to the tick bite, the insect bite. Your body had a local reaction. A little antihistamine will work. Over-the-counter Claritin or Zyrtec will be nice, or some Benadryl at bedtime if they itch. Frankly, you don't have to do anything at all, and that will work just fine for this, too.
Okay.
Where'd you get the tick? Did you go in the woods?
From the dog, she said.
Oh, from the dog.
Yeah, we play in the backyard with the ball, and when she runs back to me, she runs between my legs. For some reason, she thinks that's fun and terrific. And apparently it transferred to my body at that point.
What kind of a dog do you have?
She's part German short hair pointer, part boxer.
Oh, sounds like a cute dog. I like dogs.
Oh, she's great fun, yeah. Except that when she's a tick mobile.
There we go, and they are tick mobiles. I found a tick on my body the other day, and I thought, where did I get it? I wasn't in the woods. And then my dog jumped on me, and I thought, bingo, it's dog. That's where I got
yep.
it. So.
Well, I really appreciate your information because I was very concerned, and I didn't want to go to the expense because I don't have insurance. I didn't want to go to the expense of trying to find a doctor if it was nothing to worry
about.
You
need not worry.
You have relieved my stress. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Wonderful speaking
my
with
pleasure.
You.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Well, you mentioned a topic, Zorba, and I love this one, restless leg syndrome. Through the years, I've always wondered about restless leg syndrome and the legitimacy of this illness or ailment or what you want to call it. Now, there are going to be generic drugs for restless leg, and the story here suggests that when we don't see the ads anymore on television for the maker of the more expensive restless leg syndrome drug, they expect maybe people won't be getting restless leg syndrome
well, it's
anymore.
It's very interesting. You know, and this is a good example. Restless leg syndrome really exists. It's an honest-to-goodness thing. RLS has been around for a long time. But it's not as common as it became
yeah.
about 4 or 5 years ago when they started advertising it.
Yeah.
There were drugs that were used for off-label. I used vitamin E for years, massage therapy and other things. And then once, one of the drugs, an anti-Parkinsonian drug, became approved for restless leg syndrome, they flooded the airwaves. And lo and behold, it all of a sudden became a disease that a lot of patients would come in and say, gee, I can't get to sleep at night. I'm moving my legs. Can I have this $250 a month prescription? Of course, that's not what they said, but
yeah.
Can I have the prescription for restless leg syndrome? And it's fascinating. If you look at the Restless Leg Syndrome Foundation and they say, well, wait a minute, people are not they had a public relations announcement and they said people aren't lemmings. We can't just talk them into RLS as a syndrome and she's getting tired of it. That's the person who adds it. Well, they've got about a $1.5 million budget and one half, roughly a third to a half, comes from the drug companies that make the drugs for restless leg syndrome, lo and behold, and says, no, there's a lot of restless leg syndrome, and it's really very common. And the fact is, it's around there, but it's not that common. Now, it's true that a lot of people have trouble getting to sleep, and they move their legs, but yeah. that doesn't mean they have RLS. So all of a sudden, as the ads disappear, it'll be very interesting to see if the prevalence of restless leg syndrome in our society also begins to vanish.
And that's what they're predicting. They're predicting that as soon as the ads disappear, that far fewer of us are going to think we have restless leg syndrome.
Well, and this really is a big issue. There are two countries in the world that allow drug advertising. One is the United States. Can you guess the other country that allows it?
Wow. The United States. I have no idea.
New Zealand. That's it. The U.S. and New Zealand.
The rest of the world doesn't allow
right.
drug advertising
right.
in the media?
Right. There's no drug advertising in the media. Now, there are advertisements for certain drugs that are paid for out of pocket, Viagra, Levitra, Cialis, in a variety of countries. And those drugs are actually advertised, for instance, in Singapore. They're advertised for young men who do not have erectile dysfunction as a way to enhance sexual activity.
What do you mean
activity.
Paid for out of pocket?
Well, in other words, they're not paid for by insurance. You know, it's,
oh,
it,
yeah,
know,
I
it's
get
a drug.
It. I, get it, yeah.
I mean, Viagra is a drug of, I mean, and we can discuss erectile dysfunction, you know, as a medical problem. But in a lot of countries, it's advertised as this is a drug to enhance sexual activity and
yeah.
you don't have ED. So if you put those ads off to the side and you say that's a different thing that a drug company is advertised for, prescription drugs are not advertised in other countries.
Boy, our health insurance would go way down if we had that here, wouldn't it?
Well, that would be very interesting. Maybe our health insurance would go way down. And the drug company's profits would go way down, too.
Oh. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba, in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. What's up?
Well, first off, I just want to say thanks for taking my call. I love your show, obviously. Love NPR.
Well, thank you.
Thanks
thank
a
you.
Lot.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I had a concern, I guess a question, I've come to find out that I think I have adult attention deficit disorder. And a lot of things have been suggested to me, one of those things being Adderall. And I was curious of your thoughts on Adderall, Adderall versus Ritalin, Adderall in general, because it is an amphetamine. So
yeah, well, Zorba will help you, but what is it that leads you to believe you have adult ADD?
Well, I've taken a lot of tests concerning restlessness and productivity and just sort of anxiety and general well-being and whatnot, and just not really getting things done, having, you know, sort of the ambition to get things done, just things not really turning out the way they initially were planned to turn out.
Yeah, Zorba, we usually think about ADD as being a kid thing.
Well, it is a kid thing, but it's also an adult thing, and many children who have ADD or ADHD, you know, which is attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity, as you become an adult, you learn how to handle those things. So, for instance, maybe you have a job where you don't, if you've got ADD, you don't sit at a desk all day, but you get a job where you're out in the road, you know, doing repairs, or, you know, you're a salesman. So, you often can adapt to these things. But when it sits down, when it comes down, for instance, to concentrating at a meeting, or we'll say work you have to do on your job, it can produce a problem. So how long do you think you've had this? How old are you? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
I'm 23. I've got a degree in English. So, I mean, I got through college. I feel like I've kind of just had an attention problem my whole life. I've never really addressed it. I know there's always kind of some sort of stigma linked with ADD or ADHD. I've always been pretty, I guess, accomplished in the ways that I've wanted to be accomplished. But as far as concentrating and getting things done, it seems a lot more difficult for me than most people.
So the way I always approach ADHD is I say, first of all, and I have a number of adult patients who are on medications for this. They don't have the hyperactivity, but they find it useful. I've got a couple of engineers, people who are professors at the university where we live in Madison who have it, is first of all, they need a psychological testing to see if they really have it. Do they fit within the category? That's kind of number one. Number two is then you might do a trial of medications to see whether or not a medication will make a difference. And then if so, what's the lowest amount of medication that actually work? Now, you know, you've gone to college, you've accomplished everything, you've gone through college. So if you've got it, it's mild, because people with true ADD can't get through college. They have great difficulty. You know, we all have some difficulty concentrating. I've got a good friend of mine. He can sit down. He can concentrate for 2 or 3 hours if he's got to learn something. Well, I can't do that. I can work for about a half an hour, 45 minutes at a time. He can work for 3 hours. Am I abnormal? Well, compared to him, maybe I'm abnormal, but I'm really not abnormal. Mm-hmm. And so what you've got to do is look and say, do I want to take a drug? What do I want to accomplish? Am I having trouble meeting my goals? You kind of have to look at it together. And then, am I only going to take it during certain times? So some people will take meds before they go to a meeting. Maybe they've got a meeting which is 4 to 6 hours, and they've got to concentrate, and they'll take it. Common use of coffee, which is what I take, is to improve concentration for periods of time. I find I really like my coffee in the morning. If I don't do it, I can't concentrate. Well, this is sort of it's useful for me because I think I probably have an element of it. So one of the things, you know, especially if you may still be on insurance, is to get psychological evaluation covered by your insurance or your school. Get an evaluation if you have it. And the reason is I never put any adult on an ADD med unless they have documented ADD, documented by a psychologist through psychological testing. In other words, the question of the drug doesn't come up unless there's proof they actually have the problem. That's really step number one. And then step number two is you may find the medications really work used on a very sparing basis. I do believe in the meds. I do believe they work. But you've got to be careful with them. So that's kind of how I would perspect it.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for your opinion.
You're welcome. Good luck on your job search.
Yeah, exactly. And we appreciate the call.
Much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Have a good one.
Yeah, bye-bye. On we go, Zorba, to St. Louis, Missouri now. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. How are you today?
Fine. How can we help you?
I am a 52-year-old swimmer preparing for my third senior Olympics.
Oh.
And I have a nutrition question.
Mm-hmm.
Swimmers are a really superstitious lot. I've seen kids carry a talisman or wear a lucky pair of shorts to a meet. So when a swimmer tells me to load up on carbohydrates before a competition, I just have to wonder if that's one more superstition. Is there some nutritional research that supports carb loading?
Well, carb loading, by the way, is not limited to swimmers. It's a traditional soccer players. I have soccer boys and soccer girls in my family, and traditionally, you know, if the game was on Thursday on Wednesday night, they would eat carbohydrate loads. So what they would do is sit down for a spaghetti dinner, and that was a very traditional thing. And the concept behind it is to load your liver with glycogen. Basically, the liver is a storage of quick energy in the form of glycogen, which can be cleaved to glucose and give you quick energy. And the idea is if you eat a carb diet, really pork up with carbs, although pork would not be the appropriate thing to eat, but you would pork up with carbs before that, you would have all that carbohydrate in your liver. And so when you're ready to really get that extra burst of energy, it's there for you. Now, I've read a number of studies on this to question whether or not this really works. And the studies are kind of plus minus in that there's no really strong evidence that they work, that if you really eat a pretty good diet, your liver is probably loaded with as much carbohydrate in the form of glycogen as you could possibly have, you know, this quick glucose. On the other hand, coaches swear by it. They actually say it really does make a difference. And we know that coach psychology behind meets is really, really very important. When Roger Bannister did the 4-minute mile, right after he did it, there were 10 other people that did it within about 3 months or 4 months and did the 4-minute mile. Now, did Roger Bannister train differently? Uh-uh. Did he do anything differently than the others? Not at all. He just did it. And so other people said, gee, I can do it too, and they did it. So the answer is there's a little bit of science behind it in that you really have to have those carbs in your liver, but it's more psychological than anything else. And if you're at a meet, you want that psychological edge so you can beat your opponent.
Yes.
So you swim competitively?
Yes, and I came to this rather late. I just competed 1 year in high school, and then when I was about 48, I was online for something and realized, ooh, I can compete in Senior Olympics when I turn 50. So I started training. This gives me a really good focus
for my
workouts. It keeps me going back to the
mm-hmm.
pool.
Uh-huh, of course.
It's so easy for an older person to just blow off exercise, but Senior Olympics really helps.
I'm not familiar with the Senior Olympics. Is this worldwide competition?
I don't know about world, but it definitely is national. There are more local competitions. That's what's happening in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
There's a state level. Every other year, there's a national competition that moves around the country.
Huh. What's your strongest event?
Oh, I'm a breaststroker.
Uh-huh.
And I have had to rehab my stroke over time. My daughter looked at it about 7 years ago. She's a competitive swimmer. And said, oh, you're doing it all wrong. Well, that's the way I learned it in high school. Leave it to the kids to teach us things.
Well, yeah, best of luck to you.
Well, thank you very much.
We'll look for your name in the sports section.
Oh, don't be that impressed. But I would encourage people to compete.
Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we won't be loading you up with carbs with our recipe coming up for spring-loaded turkey breasts. More research to talk about in our medical MythBuster. Of course, more of your calls here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Do you have a question for Zorba? Well, we have callers waiting, but a line open now for you at 1-800-462-7413. But Zorba, before we take our next call, let's get to this spring-loaded turkey breast recipe, which we have sitting right between us.
So this implies from the name that it's loaded with a spring, right?
Well, it's spring loaded, you would assume.
like a shotgun loaded. But it's actually loaded with spring veggies, and you don't have to use just spring veggies. But the
good
idea
play
is,
on words.
You know, let's figure, I'll put some veggies in here.
Yeah.
Turkey, I like as a protein. I'm an omnivore. I eat vegetables. I eat pretty much anything that's on my plate. I certainly will try. I like to use turkey. Turkey breast is a good white meat that is lower in fat than turkey thighs. When you're looking for ground turkey, you want to have ground turkey breast because it'll have less fat in it than ground turkey thighs. And we don't use turkey breast as much as we could. It's just
this is good for me. You won't believe this, but I'm actually trying to cut back on beef.
Oh, I can't believe it. Oh, I can't believe it. What has come on? Tom has an epiphany. He's cutting back on beef.
So,
what happened?
So
what's your motivation?
I don't know. It just occurred to me that I may be eating a little more beef than I should.
Maybe you're learning something from the show after 500 years.
Eating a lot of chicken and turkey. So this will be good.
Breast. Yeah. Good example. So start out with 8 ounces of turkey breasts cut into strips.
Now, this is going to feed...
This will feed two people. I'll tell you something. It's a good size recipe. It'll feed two people who are really hungry. It'll actually feed more like 3 or 4 people.
Oh, okay. 8 ounces of turkey breasts cut into strips.
That's right. 1.5 teaspoons of dried tarragon.
1.5 little tea dried tarragon.
1 tablespoonful of olive oil.
1 big tea olive oil.
1 cup of leeks. Thinly sliced.
That's sliced.
Right, leeks, thinly sliced.
That's what these things are.
That's
leeks.
Right, they're leeks, okay. thinly sliced. 3/4 cup of baby carrots cut in half.
3/4 cup of baby carrots cut in half.
1.25 cups of low-sodium chicken broth.
1.25 cups of low-sodium chicken broth.
And I use low-sodium chicken broth because we tend to have too much salt, and this way you can salt it to your taste.
Okay.
A 1/4 cup of dry white cooking wine.
1/4 cup of dry white cooking wine.
Now, my favorite cooking wine is vermouth. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. Do not buy an expensive vermouth. It lasts forever. Cooking wine, when you get it in the store, has sugar added to it for the most part. Turns out to be much too expensive for what you get. And so you buy a fifth of vermouth and use it as cooking wine. It lasts for a long time.
Okay.
3/4 cup of frozen peas.
3/4 cup of frozen peas.
And if you want to, if pea pods are in season, as they tend to be, of course, in the springtime, you can use those. So pea pods are great. 1 tablespoonful of all-purpose flour.
1 big tea all-purpose flour.
That's right. Regular white flour and salt and pepper to taste.
S&P.
That's right. So let's put it together. Season the turkey with 1 teaspoon of tarragon, some salt and pepper. Then in a large skillet, heat the olive oil over high heat. Sauté the turkey until brown, just a few minutes. Then remove the turkey, saving the juice, and remove the heat to medium. And when you remove the turkey, if there's anything on the bottom of the pan, it's important to get that off and use it. It has a lot of taste to it. Then add the leeks, carrots, and remaining tarragon to the skillet. Cook until the leeks soften. That's about 3 minutes. Sprinkle the flour over the veggies and cook for another minute while that thickens. Slowly add the broth and the wine to the skillet. Simmer uncovered, stirring occasionally until the sauce is really thickened. That takes about 10 minutes. Add the turkey and the peas and simmer until heated through the turkey. We just want to warm up. Season with salt and pepper again and serve it, and it is delicious. You are eating this.
It really is delicious. You know what? I had a leek. I don't know if I've ever had a leek before. At least tastes pretty good.
Delicious, delicious. Adam made a wonderful rendition of this. Leeks are wonderful.
And you know what? If you're a vegetarian, you could leave the turkey out, and the rest of this recipe would
use veggie broth instead. Absolutely, it's a great recipe. Nutritionally, it's great. About 287 calories per serving. You've got 14% of the fat you need for your day, and 48% of the protein. In other words, for this recipe, you have half the protein you need for the entire day from the turkey breast.
And you know what?
It's a great recipe.
It looks pretty, too.
It looks pretty, too, Tom. I can't believe it. From a meat eater. From a beef eater.
Well, let us send this recipe to you. You will love it. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip code 53706. Don't forget to enclose a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope. We'll send it along to you.
Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org. There you can look at that recipe, look at our resource page, and sign up for our podcast.
Back to the phones we go at 1-800-462-7413. Ann Zorba, a listener with us now in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, I have questions concerning shingles. I have been diagnosed with them and put on a huge round of medications, and then I have other questions concerning neuralgia in general because my husband has that. So I'm wanting Zorba's input on it.
Yeah, shingles is not a pleasant thing to get at all. It's a common thing. So how long after the rash did you actually start on medication?
Well, I didn't go to the doctor for one full week because I thought I had had a reaction to a piece of clothing. I have sensitive skin.
Oh, sure. Easy thing to think about. So were you put on an antiviral medication? Is that what you were put on or something for pain?
I was put on Valtrex, and she warned me that it was late to get on
that's
it.
Right,
but I thought,
that's right.
Well,
that's right. The issue is the studies have shown if you're on it within 3 days of the onset, it helps, and if it's after 3 days, doesn't do anything. On the other hand, I, too, at 1 week will say to people, I don't think this is going to do much. Do you want to try it? And they usually go, this is so painful, I want to try anything. So
yeah.
I think a lot of – it's exactly what a lot of physicians do. They go, hey, I think I am going to, you know, offer that to the patient. The issue with shingles are this. The pain can last for a long time, and the way to get rid of the pain is go on an excellent pain medication, either gabapentin, which is a generic drug of Neurontin, or Lyrica. Lyrica is another drug, which is pregabalin. These are two drugs that are anti-seizure drugs that help a lot with shingles pain. And when the sores heal, you can go on a lidoderm patch, which is a patch which is loaded with lidocaine. And they really, really do help, along with some hydrocodone and other medications that help. How long ago did you come down with the rash?
It would be exactly 3 weeks today.
Well, I would stay on it. First of all, I would stay on the drugs a minimum of a month, but many people stay on the drugs for 2 to 3 months because the pain can still be there. And I wouldn't stop both of them at one time. I would stop one or the other. Wouldn't matter to me which one, but I wouldn't stop both. I'd stop one, wait a week, and stop the other. But I talked to your doc first. I certainly wouldn't do it before a month. And now this is, of course, the chance to talk about the shingles vaccine. You don't need it because your body is developing a robust response, most likely, to the reactivation of the chickenpox virus. But it's a good reason to think about the shingles vaccine because it does help for people. And you know, but once you've had it, there's no reason to get it. Does your husband has your husband had shingles at all?
Well, we believe that my husband has shingles that did not surface.
Right, you can get that. You can get shingles that do not surface. But it's really rare. It's very, very unusual. It's really, really rare to get a shingles case that hasn't surfaced. But once again, the shingles vaccine is good for people. It sounds like you're on exactly the right stuff for the pain. And remember, you are catchy to people who have not had chickenpox, which includes very, very small children before they've gotten the chickenpox vaccine, or adults who have never had chickenpox. As long as those sores are oozing, the chickenpox virus is living in that sore.
Okay, because that was another question I have. Is it contagious?
You bet. That's how we know it's the chickenpox virus, because we know that people who came into contact with somebody with shingles, they haven't had chickenpox, they can get chickenpox. As an adult, it's a big issue. It's a big issue. So you stay away from anyone who has not had chickenpox or the vaccine.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're on the right drugs.
Okay, I appreciate your input.
You take care now.
Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 800-462-7413. And a listener now, Zorba, in Palatka, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I was. I have a thing with my scalp. It's not dandruff. It's like, they're like sores just at the base of my hairline. On both sides of the forehead, they haven't really spread or expanded. but they're just sort of, it's been persistent for quite a while.
Do they hurt a lot?
No, no. But there are little, they get little scabs on there, and I've been using dandruff shampoo and different things, but nothing seems to, you know, like I say, it hasn't spread.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure what it is.
Do you wear a hat or a cap?
No, I don't. No, I'm not a hat person.
Oh. Uh-huh.
How long have you had them?
This has been going on about a year.
About a year. Now, you haven't seen a doctor about this?
No, I haven't.
So you've had these for a year, so and you haven't seen a doctor after a year. It's kind of a long time to have these things on your scalp.
Well,
don't people come down the street and go, "Hey, what's that on your scalp? You've got scabs at the base of your hair."
Well, I've got a rather casual haircut, so they fall down.
A casual haircut versus the formal haircut with the buttoned up tie and appearance. I've got the casual haircut, which means you cover it with your hair.
You're one of them hippie guys. Huh?
Well, let's not go into that. I never outgrew my hippie days. You've pegged me. I'm of that genre. Yes,
I'm of that genre. That's
well, of that decade or that. I'm of that vintage, anyway. Anyway, but it's not dandruff, and I'm just curious what it is. And it's not, they're not painful.
Mm-hmm. What kind of shampoo have you used?
Well, I usually use like Pantene. I tend to pamper myself in that respect, but I use Head and Shoulders now too.
Uh-huh.
But it hasn't done any.
You
any
pamper
good
yourself with a more expensive shampoo? Is that what you
mean?
Well,
I don't pamper myself any other way.
Yeah.
That's my big expense in life.
That's your big expense is shampoo in life.
Yeah.
So getting back to it, there are a whole bunch of different things that can occur in the scalp. But one of my recommendations is that you switch to a different shampoo, either Selsun Blue or you get a tar shampoo. There are a number of tar shampoos you can get.
A tar shampoo? What is that?
Well, they're tar. They're right in the shampoo aisle, medicated shampoo, and they're made with tar. They have a coal tar in the shampoo. They're used for psoriasis, for eczema, for a whole variety of other problems that occur on the scalp. And basically, I would initially try Selsun Blue because you can buy it over the counter, leave it on the scalp for 5 minutes. Then wash it off.
Mm-hmm.
Try that for 2 weeks. If that does it, well, basically it's a dermatological condition. Could be eczema, could be psoriasis, could be something called seborrheic dermatitis, a bunch of other things. But if it works, you don't have to see a doctor. Now, if that doesn't work, go to the tar shampoo. And the tar shampoo is not as aesthetically enjoyable because tar has a slight odor to it. It smells like tar. Mm-hmm. And so, but tar is very, very effective. And once again, I'd give that 2 to 4 weeks to see if it works. From a diagnostic point of view, it's very hard to figure out what this is. But
right.
If it's an infection, it would have been red and hot and swollen and you'd have pus coming out of your scalp.
No.
It's not an infection.
No.
You know, because even you with your casual haircut would probably see someone with pus was coming out of your scalp.
Yeah. I just want to say, Doctor, that when you say I thought I was going to have to go to the tire shop because in this area, a tar is something that you put on your you got four tires on your car and you got a spare tar in the trunk. We're actually South Georgia.
I've got it. I can't do the accent, but
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the call. Before we break, Zorba, let's stop at the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and see if we can help one of our listeners, Mike, from going nuts. He writes, "I don't really care for nuts prepared with oils and generally won't eat them. However, I find that dry roasted nuts are usually laden with flavor-enhancing salts, which I avoid like plague. Are there any other options?"
Absolutely. Go to an organic grocery store, get yourself some nuts that are not laden with flavor enhancers and eat those. There are a lot of different nut combinations you can get. They're commercial products, but basically you want to go to an organic product that doesn't have this other junk, as I would call it, within the nuts. You don't want the oil in nuts for sure, because oil clearly is going to increase the amount of oil that you're eating, and we don't need that. And nuts have enough oil, and they have good oil. Nuts have good oil, but the stuff they fry the nuts in or put them in do not. So you need an organic nut. And an organic store will help you. Stores such as Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, a whole bunch of other stores will have that,
But the problem with those nuts that don't have the added oil and don't have the salt, they don't taste good.
They don't taste good. Right. Well, that's you learn. It's a different taste.
We like hearing from you. Send us your thoughts in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Guess what? Lots more coming up here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have some more research. We have our medical myth buster, all coming to you right here from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before we get back to the phones, really interesting info on the effect of smoking bans in restaurants, the effect on teenagers.
Right, right. First of all, there are a number of states that have enacted smoking bans. Over 20 states have said public places, restaurants, bars, taverns, workplaces will not have smoking. Many states in the country have outlawed smoking within public places such as the workplace. Mm-hmm. And the issues of these statewide bans come up, and what you have is you have people on both sides of the issues. Yes, I should be allowed to smoke in a bar. Yes, I should be allowed to smoke in a restaurant. And the issue is, what do these effects have on our teenagers? I mean, that's an important aspect in terms of this fight. I, by the way, want to state absolutely 100%, I think there should be no smoking in any restaurant or any bar in the United States of America all over. But, I mean, it's a state-by-state
issue.
Well,
what about the effect on teens of these bans?
Well, this was in Massachusetts. When they first started in Massachusetts, there were no smoking bans. And then eventually different municipalities around the state encouraged smoking bans. They looked at teenage smoking rates, which they look for trends, to find out whether or not there was a difference. And they defined smokers, you know, kids who smoked a certain number of cigarettes. And what they found was that when there was a smoking ban, there was a significant drop, a decline, from about 20% of teenagers who were smoking, you know, on and off, to about 18% and appeared to be trending down. In other words, about a roughly about a 3-5% drop if smoking was not present in public places. So in other words, there was a drop in smoking of maybe up to 5% or more in teenage smoking in places where there were public smoking bans.
Hmm. So the thought is then that if the teens don't see people smoking in restaurants all the time,
they don't smoke.
They tend to be less likely to smoke.
Now, the issue is very interesting. You know, teens we know smoke for a lot of complex reasons. They think it's, you know, it's cool, it's sexy, it's adult-like and so on. And so, you know, they take a lot of cues from the environment. Well, it appears now if there's no smoking in the environment, teens are less likely to smoke. They're getting a cue from society that you don't smoke around here.
I've got to say, though, that this decrease doesn't seem that significant, from 20% or so to 18%.
Yeah, well, 20%. Let's say 20% to 18% or 17% times millions and millions and millions and millions of teenagers. It is a very significant number. Anytime you get it to drop, right now 20% of Americans smoke, and if we dropped it to 15% of Americans, we would essentially drop the death rate by about 20 or 30,000 people a year from smoking. So any drop is a significant drop, and it's very clear that when there's no smoking in the community, teens take a cue and they're less likely to smoke. And to me as a parent, that's important.
800-462-7413 to talk with Zorba. A listener now in Lac des Flambeaux, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thanks for having me on the show.
You bet. Thanks for calling. How can we help you?
Say, I have a question. I'm a competitive cross-country skier, and in the off-season, I train, do some weight training and some running. And I've heard a lot about the benefits of exercising barefoot and also disadvantages. And I'm just curious for your insight on the topic.
Yeah. What advantages have you heard about?
Well, I've heard for people without pre-existing foot issues that you can actually strengthen your feet and then also strengthen your overall balance for lower and upper body.
So when you're talking about running outside or inside?
Well, primarily for inside training, doing stretching, yoga, weight training, but then also outside using shoes that allow your feet to naturally move and expand as you run, mm-hmm. but also protect the soles of your feet from the ground.
Well, the issue of protecting the soles of the feet, that's a biggie. So
sure.
First of all, let's assume you're not running barefoot because it's not good. You know, you're likely to get sores and things in your feet. And one of the ways that, and there's not much hookworm in America anymore, but one of the big ways to cut down on hookworm, which was very prevalent in the South in the early 1900s, was to wear shoes. So I think shoes outside are really an important thing to do unless you know the track that you're on and you take care of it. From a point of view of exercise, your feet are still going to move, you know, within your shoe. If you have a well-balanced shoe with an arch that gives you support, your feet are going to move. They're going to move differently, of course, if there's no arch at all that you're pushing against. From a competitive point of view, I think, frankly, if we knew that that competing barefoot and that training barefoot for runners was good, then you would find a whole bunch of Olympic officials, you know, all over the world training on a barefoot course. So, I mean, I can't answer that part because I'm not a trainer. But from a cardiovascular point of view or view of your muscles, I don't see where going barefoot would make a difference because you're still jumping on the ground, you're moving back and forth. I don't know why it would matter one way or the other. Have you been training barefoot now?
Well, when I train inside, when I do any weight training or body resistance training or yoga, I do that barefoot. However, outside I do use running shoes for the obvious reasons of protecting my feet. But I'm actually looking into getting a pair of shoes that allow my foot to move barefoot in essentially a barefoot manner.
And you, as I understand, Zorba, you don't really see any advantages.
Well,
to the barefoot.
But I think when you're looking at yoga, you know, people do not do yoga with shoes. They usually do yoga barefoot because that's a very good example of where you want to have really good tactile kinesiology, a kinesiology sense of exactly how you're stretching, where the soles of your feet are, how you're moving. And I think from a balance point of view, barefoot, when you're doing yoga or balance exercises, is great idea. And I think inside, if you find you have more strength, more endurance, more strength, or better balance by working in a barefoot manner, that's a good idea too. Outside, I like the cushion on the foot, and I wonder whether or not you're going to develop plantar fasciitis by running outside because basically you're flying. When you're running, you're jumping essentially through the air and landing on irregular ground, which may have little pebbles in it and stones, and that's why we wear soles in our shoes, because generally if you walk barefoot or even with a very light sole that doesn't have any sponginess to it, it's going to disturb the bottom of your foot, and that might be painful.
Well, let me ask the caller, and I know nothing about this issue, but you're training for competition. Doesn't it make more sense to train the same way with the same gear that you'd be using in the competition?
Well, that's an interesting question because the off-season training for skiing is varied. You know, in the wintertime we have ski boots on and skis, and in the summertime we have to adjust to not having snow or the ability to ski. So we go through a big variation of equipment that we use anyhow. So
absolutely. I think if you have a balance, I would question the outside stuff once again because I think you may get plantar fasciitis. I'd be aware of that. Once you get plantar fasciitis, it takes a while to get better. And anyone who has it will say they're sorry that they have it. Inside, totally different issue because you've got control of the environment. So I like a spongy sole, I think. It doesn't have to be thick, but I think it ought to be something on there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Let's get to our medical myth buster now, Zorba. Today's myth has been seen on TV and in films for nearly as long as they've been around, but is it effective? It's the old thought that when you are hyperventilating, you should grab the nearest brown paper bag and breathe into it.
And the answer is yes, it is effective. But The question is, should you do it? There's no doubt about it that it's effective. I used to work in the emergency room. We'd have people who hyperventilated. We would have the nurse go in there or the medical assistant or myself and have them breathe into a paper bag because basically you're re-breathing your air. You're increasing the carbon dioxide that you're essentially breathing in, and that often will stop the hyperventilation. But for people with heart failure, for people for asthma, you can get worse. And the reality is we know if you can just calm down from hyperventilation, you don't need a paper bag. So the real issue is the paper bag essential or is it the paper bag and knowing the paper bag is working that is really doing the trick? And the answer is use of the bag is okay in somebody without asthma or heart disease, but frankly, calming down is safer.
So as far as I know, I don't have asthma or heart disease. If I hyperventilate, I should grab the brown
100%,
paper bag.
It's going to work for you, and it's not dangerous unless you've got a problem.
Interested in having Zorba bust your myth? Send it along in an email
to zorba@wpr.org.
Want to talk with Zorba? Use 800-462-7413. To Vineland, New Jersey now. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thanks for taking me on your show.
Yeah.
I am a poison ivy sufferer. And as a child, I think I am pretty sure I remember it one year getting a series of four shots and then every year a booster. And I was out of the country for 10 years. I was in Germany where they don't have poison ivy. I've come back and I'm suffering from poison ivy again. And I've asked the doctor and they said there's no such thing as a shot against poison ivy.
Well, the shots against poison ivy were called Ivyol. That was the name. That was the generic name of the, or the name brand of the drug,
Ivyol.
And they were given. For a number of years. It's an interesting drug because it was grandfathered in. It was a drug that was never tested. Essentially, years ago, pre 1970s, the FDA approved drugs with maybe 5 people in the study or 10 people in the study. And this is one of the drugs that was actually approved. So Ivyol was a drug that was used. And then what happened was the feds came in and said, well, now you have to prove it's safe and effective. And the reality was not only was it not necessarily safe, but it wasn't effective. It really actually didn't do anything. And I don't know what it had in it. I'm sure it wasn't snake oil, but it didn't have very much in it at all. What do you do for your poison ivy? Do you get it every year? Or
oh, yeah. I suffer really badly all the time every year.
Well, what... do you know where you're getting your poison ivy from?
I can go swimming in a lake and get poison ivy from swimming.
Oh, that's really, smoke can do it. Clothing, of course, can do it.
I'm imagining the oils are floating on the surface because when I swim, I get poison ivy all around my swimsuit line.
Well, you are clearly swimming in the wrong lakes. I mean, if you're swimming in poison ivy infested lakes and areas, that's basically what it is. Do you go to a country lake? Is that what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I live in Vineland, and poison ivy is
right.
Vine. So,
right.
I mean, it's...
It's just all around. And that's the problem, is that when it's just all around the community, you just get it from everywhere. One of my recommendations, though, is look at your clothing, because the oil that gets on the clothing is the thing that a lot of people don't pay attention to, and that's what they often will get poison ivy from. The oil that's on the surface of the plant rubs on the clothing and then essentially gets into your skin and causes the problem. So, sorry, the drug is
here's my next question. So if I swam naked, I wouldn't get poison ivy?
No, if you swam naked, well, the answer is maybe yes and maybe no. If you are getting the poison ivy and the poison ivy is essentially coming on the leaves as you're going into the lake, basically you may be getting it from the swimsuit, but then it would rub against your skin as you went into there. But the answer is yes, it might be on your swimsuit, and you might be actually getting it by touching your swimsuit, so you have to look around and see if that's it. So are you going to swim naked?
Not if I don't want to get arrested.
No. See, just tell the officer, I'm swimming naked.
Yeah.
My doctor told me I have to swim naked in order to make sure I don't get poison ivy. That's okay. I'll write you a note. No problem.
With the Ivyol shots that I got, were they dangerous? Do I have to worry about...
No.
genetic damage. What happened to me from having taken this poison ivy shot?
I don't think that they were dangerous. They probably were saline. That's probably what the shots were. I don't know. I really don't know what was in there. I think if you Google the name Ivyol, you might be able to pull out something. But I don't think they were dangerous. I don't think you're going to have any permanent.
Not to worry now on anything.
There are other things to worry about. I wouldn't worry about the Ivyol shot. So good luck on the swimming.
Thank you very much.
Sure, appreciate the call. Thank you. And as a special treat to our listeners, we talked about poison ivy maybe three or four times during the years of the program. For the first time, I am not going to recount that boring story of me as a kid at the cabin.
Thank you, Tom.
Instead of that, Zorba, let's take a moment to see if we can help out Josh in Ripon, Wisconsin. Josh writes, I'm a camp counselor in the summer, and it's important that my campers can wake me up in the middle of the night if they wet the bed, feel homesick, emergencies, etc. But it's almost impossible to wake me up. I sleep very soundly, and my body is the only thing that can wake me up correctly. Also, sometimes when they try to wake me up, I will start sleepwalking, talking, etc., and have no recollection of it the next day. I've even made a fire, eaten s'mores, and had conversations in my sleep.
Gosh, he's had a fire and eaten s'mores at a conversation. Well, this is an interesting issue. First of all, he can be woken, awakened, essentially, by stimulating the body enough, moving the body enough, putting cold water on the face, for instance, patting cold water. You can wake people up in all situations. But he's going into a reverie and sleepwalking, night terrors, all of this sort of semi-sleep, semi-wakeful states can be very, very difficult, especially if somebody is awakened and they're in this semi-sleep state and they do something dangerous, such as starting a fire, because you're not fully conscious. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for him, if the kids want to wake him up, to say, look, you've got to wake me up. Maybe keep some water at your bed, squirt gun. Often water will wake people up.
Do you think the kids would really be willing to squirt somebody with a squirt gun?
I wonder if those boys in the cabin would really want to use a squirt gun to work the counselor up. And that generally will work and do the trick. And that's my recommendation.
Well, let's hope Josh was awake to hear your advice. Want to chime in? Send us your lifestyle questions, comments, and tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
A pleasure to be here, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0531Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.